ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 11th of February. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. There's been a second night of protests in Sydney and more expected in other capitals today as Israeli President Isaac Herzog continues his Australian visit. Nine pro-Palestinian protesters have been charged over Monday's demonstration in Sydney, where violent clashes broke out between ralliers and police. Crowds gathered last night to condemn the police response, but the state government is standing behind the actions of its officers. Annie Guest has more.
Protest is not a crime! Genocide is the crime!
Another rally by pro-Palestinian protesters in Sydney, this time outside the police headquarters in Surry Hills yesterday evening.
To recommit ourselves to the fight for a free Palestine and against this police state.
They came to voice their anger at police after news that protesters had been charged for clashes with officers on Monday night at Sydney's town hall.
We saw Muslim men on their knees literally praying be attacked by police!
Speaking outside the police station last night was protest organiser Josh Lees.
We saw a man with his hands up like this being pummeled by two or three riot police.
Despite one scuffle and a protester being detained by police, this rally was far more peaceful than the previous evening. On Monday afternoon, New South Wales Police Commissioner Mal Lanyon used new powers to restrict to one area those protesting against Israeli President Isaac Herzog's visit to Australia. But some tried to breach police lines and march to state parliament. Video shows some police punching protesters. It also shows police physically moving some Muslim men who were praying. Civil rights groups are outraged, but New South Wales Premier Chris Minns is sticking by the decision to limit protests against President Herzog, and he's defending the actions of police on Monday night.
They were caught in an impossible situation. It is a difficult, combustible situation, but if the protest organisers had elected to have their rally in Hyde Park as opposed to Town Hall, where it was a narrow area where there wasn't an opportunity to march, then most of this could have been avoided, we believe.
But Associate Professor Maria O'Sullivan, who's an expert on protest laws at Deakin University, has doubts about the legality of how police use their special powers and move-on directions, which were granted to them under the Major Events Act.
It was still lawful for the protesters to utilise that route that they used starting at Town Hall, but it did mean that the police powers that were given under the Major Events Act, like move-on directions, were used against the protesters. There is a question, though, I would say, about whether those powers were proportionate.
That might be tested if some of the protesters who've been arrested have their cases heard in court. And a separate court challenge is already scheduled over the post-Bondi massacre public assembly restrictions, allowing police to limit CBD and eastern suburbs protests.
Annie Guest and David Sparks with that report. Well, away from the protests, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese hosted President Herzog for dinner at Kirribilli House last night. The head of state is still expected to touch down in Melbourne and Canberra before flying home on Thursday. ACT police say a significant police presence is ready in anticipation of further protests. Here's political reporter Sarah Tomevska.
We need to turn the temperature down.
A parliament grappling with the fallout of the state visit of Israeli President Isaac Herzog as protests are expected to continue in Melbourne and Canberra. ACT Senator David Pocock says the visit is fueling division.
The PM said that this visit was about bringing unity. Clearly, that has not happened. We've seen police crackdowns on protests. We've seen more disunity. And I think the government needs to admit that this was a mistake.
Senior Liberal and Jewish MP Julian Lisa strongly supports the president's visit.
Well, he is the head of the Jewish state, and Jewish people have been targeted and murdered in cold blood at the worst terrorist attack ever in the history of this country.
He says protests against Isaac Herzog's presence have re-traumatised the Jewish community and conflate Israel's actions abroad accord with people of Jewish faith.
People are free to criticise the policies of the government of Israel, but what they're not free to do is to hold Jewish people in this country collectively responsible for the policies of the government of Israel.
In January 2024, the International Court of Justice found it plausible Israel's actions in Gaza could violate the Genocide Convention. Separately, Isaac Herzog has rejected the findings of a UN Human Rights Council commission of inquiry that he's among three Israeli leaders to have incited genocide through his comments that an entire nation was responsible for Hamas's October 7 terror attack. Mr. Herzog later said there are many innocent Palestinians and that his comments were taken out of context.
In the full context of what was happening at the time and other things that Herzog himself said, we came to the conclusion that his words were an incitement to genocide.
Human rights lawyer Chris Sidoti is one of the UN commissioners. He believes Mr. Herzog's visit should never have gone ahead.
The Prime Minister has said that the purpose of the visit is to provide comfort, to mourn with the Australian Jewish community. Herzog has said that that's one of his objectives, but not even the main objective. He has said that he has come to set Australians right, to set us straight about what Israel is doing, and to restore the relationship between Australia and Israel to that before October 2023. Now, these are not purposes of mourning. They are purposes of political support building and propaganda.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says regardless of what the public thinks of Israel's actions in Gaza, President Herzog is welcome in Australia.
He is here primarily to provide comfort for people who not only need it, but they deserve it at this time.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese ending Sarah Temevska's report. Well, there are growing calls for Liberal frontbencher Angus Taylor to either prove he has the numbers to be opposition leader or put the talk to bed. Mr. Taylor still hasn't declared his intentions, but speculation is rampant he's planning to challenge Susan Lee for the top job, and perhaps as soon as today. Federal political reporter Isabella Tolhurst is at Parliament House in Canberra. Bella, does it seem like patience is wearing thin with Angus Taylor and his camp?
Well, our patience is wearing thin as observers of this debacle, so you can really only imagine the stress going on within the Liberal Party itself, yet alone for leader Susan Lee, who has been really immobilised by this internal division. But Isabella, things are really beginning to heat up in this race that's yet to even have been formally declared. The former Prime Minister and the last Liberal leader to undergo a spill motion of his own, Malcolm Turnbull, was here in Parliament yesterday afternoon. He demanded that if Angus Taylor intends to run for leader, he needs to stand up, declare it, and say why he would be a good leader. He didn't go as far as to endorse Angus Taylor. He just said that he is an eligible leader because he is a member of the House of Representatives. Other Liberal members have also shared the sentiment wanting an end to all of this uncertainty. There's this growing sense now that a motion needs to be moved by the end of the week, and we've only got one more sitting day after today, so movements need to be made as soon as possible. Now, some moderate members have demanded that Angus Taylor's supporters gather a petition of signatures to prove that he has the numbers to instigate a spill, all to really either get things moving or shut this speculation down for good.
And Bella, one of the first signs usually that something is going to happen is we see resignations from Shadow Cabinet, but we haven't seen anything like that yet, have we?
No, we haven't had a resignation yet, but the ABC does understand that Angus Taylor is expected to resign from his position on the front bench as early as today, as early as this morning. That could trigger some more resignations from his supporters from their front bench positions in order to build momentum in his favour. Now, the Liberal Party hasn't codified the rules around processes to hold a leadership spill. We've heard that there's not much of an appetite to go down this petition pathway, which is what Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull insisted on when he was losing the support of his colleagues. He wanted a petition to weigh up the numbers. There's little appetite to do that in this scenario. But the reason behind these resignations is that in order to criticise or she'll go against their leader, Susan Lee, they can't be sitting on the front bench. Now, Angus Taylor has really consistently urged his supporters to sort of hold back and let Susan Lee have a bit more time in the leadership role. But as this debate goes on, it's becoming increasingly clear that that is not going to be allowed to happen. He'll have to either come forward and announce that he is wanting to make a move for leader or step out of the race altogether.
Well, sounds like it could be a busy day down in Canberra, Bella. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Isabella Tolhurst at Parliament House. In the United States, the FBI have released new photographs of a suspect in the apparent abduction of Nancy Guthrie. The 84-year-old mother of the Australian-born TV anchor Savannah Guthrie has been missing for more than a week. Emily Gremenz is in our Washington office and has been following the story. Emily, what do these new pictures show?
The FBI director, Kash Patel, said in a social media post that these pictures were retrieved by the FBI and local police. They were recovered from residual data in the back-end systems of a camera at Nancy Guthrie's front door. The pictures are in black and white. They show someone with a mask over their face, only their eyes and mouth are visible. They're wearing black leather gloves, a backpack, and it looks like they have something holstered to their front that looks like a firearm. Kash Patel said these images show an individual who is armed, who appears to be tampering with the doorbell camera. Now, they look to be reaching towards the camera with a closed fist in the still images, and then in videos that the FBI have released, they approach the front door with their head down, they reach for the camera, they turn around, and they appear to pull a plant out of the front garden to try and obscure that camera. Now, Kash Patel says that these images show someone who is armed and they are appealing for information from the public.
Emily, this is such a high-profile case. Have police been able to have many breakthroughs?
This is really the most significant breakthrough that police have shared with the public since Nancy Guthrie disappeared at the start of this month. Her daughter, Savannah Guthrie, is a very well-known TV host here. This case has attracted a lot of attention. Savannah Guthrie herself posted these photos on social media a short time after they were released, and she said, "Someone out there recognises this person. We believe she is still out there. Bring her home," with an appeal for anyone with information to call the FBI or the local police. And the President of the United States, Donald Trump, has himself been very engaged in this case, as have numerous members of the public. His press secretary, Caroline Levitt, happened to be holding a briefing this afternoon, just a short time after these pictures were released. And she said she'd reviewed that footage with the president. She commented on it and she renewed their call for anyone with information to come forward.
His initial reaction, of course, as all Americans, is just pure disgust. And again, it's heartbreaking to see now this footage really bring to life a story we've all been reading about. And again, we're just praying for the safety of Nancy Guthrie and that she will return home soon.
That's White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt. And before her, our correspondent Emily Gremenz in Washington. Soccer's world governing body FIFA has intervened in a dispute between Palestinian refugees and Israeli authorities over the future of a soccer field in the occupied West Bank. Israel has ordered the pitch at the Ada refugee camp be demolished, but an international campaign is fighting to save it. Correspondent Bridget Rollison filed this report from Bethlehem.
For Janet Jabba, playing soccer on the pitch at the Ida refugee camp is more than just a pastime. It's a pathway. The 15-year-old has played for Palestine's national team and has ambitions of one day pulling on a Real Madrid jersey.
All our dreams are here, and we work hard in order to be in a strong team like Real Madrid. My dream is to play for Real Madrid.
But that dream and the dreams of hundreds of other refugees who train here every week are under threat. Israeli authorities have ordered the pitch, which is the only one in the Bethlehem area, be demolished, claiming it was built illegally.
It made no sense for us. Why it made no sense? Because we don't believe like there is anyone would like to take away like the smile or prevent the children from the right to play.
Mohammed Abu Suror from the Ida Youth Centre says more than 5,000 people live in the overcrowded camp, which was designed for just 1,000 refugees to house Palestinians displaced by the Arab-Israeli war. The soccer field hugs the Israeli separation wall, which cuts through the occupied West Bank, and the Israel Defence Force says it needs to be demolished because it's a security issue. But Mr. Saror maintains they have the proper permits.
This space was a dream for us. This is a space where we express ourselves as a resident, as a refugee, as a football player, as a children. We do not have any other space.
Here's 17-year-old player Salma.
We all sad and we was crying about this. All our dreams grow with us here, and it's so hard to believe that it's gonna demolish this field.
A global campaign has been launched to save the pitch, with a petition attracting nearly 500,000 signatures. It's triggered a rare intervention from soccer's most powerful bodies, FIFA and UEFA, which have stepped in to pressure Israeli authorities to reconsider. There are reports the demolition has been put on hold for now. But Ida Youth Centre coach Mahmoud Jundia says the camp has received no confirmation from Israeli officials.
The pitch fulfills the dreams of our children. If the pitch is demolished, it will have a negative impact on them emotionally.
Mr. Jundia fears the final whistle could come at any time. This is Bridget Rollison in Bethlehem, reporting for AM.
Ride-sharing company Uber has quietly agreed to an external review of its Australian operations after settling a federal court challenge brought by a woman who was refused more than 30 rides while travelling with a guide dog. Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella has more.
Paula Hobley is feeling exhausted after what she describes as a David versus Goliath battle with Uber.
It's one person taking an entire company to forge a path towards justice. And it's frustrating and mystifying why it had to come to this.
First reported by the ABC last year, Ms. Hobley, who is blind, alleged drivers broke disability discrimination laws by refusing to pick up her guide dog more than 30 times. The Victorian woman and Uber settled the federal court case late last year without admission of liability after mediation. As part of the settlement, Uber has agreed to be subject to an external review of its operations. It'll examine Uber drivers' refusals to transport people with assistance animals and be chaired by a person with disability. After the review, the chair will make recommendations and then evaluate Uber's implementation of those recommendations. All that information is expected to be released by 2028. Ms. Hobley says she's frustrated it took legal proceedings to get Uber to properly look into the issue of guide dog refusals.
Even throughout the period of the court case, I still did encounter refusals.
Mitchell Skipsey, senior solicitor at the Justice and Equity Centre, which represented Ms. Hobley, says the commitment to the review is a step forward. But he warns the issue is not yet fixed and guide dog handlers could still be refused Uber rides in the meantime.
This two-year period, it's a necessary evil, we think. The shame here is that it hasn't happened sooner, that the 2 years, as it were, starts from now, when it's been a problem for a long time and it's the kind of thing that could have been tackled earlier.
The Disability Discrimination Act, state laws and Uber's own policies all require drivers to provide services to people with assistance animals. A 2024 Guide Dogs Australia survey found almost 50% of handlers had been refused a rideshare or taxi trip in the 2 years prior. Uber didn't respond to the ABC's questions about who specifically would chair the review, what the terms of reference for it were, whether it would release interim updates, and why it took until now to agree to a review of its operations. A company spokesperson said the terms of the settlement were confidential and pointed the ABC to a statement already published online that said the distress of being refused service because of an assistance animal is not something taken lightly. It said Uber had invested heavily to ensure drivers understood their legal obligations to provide service to riders with assistance animals. Ms. Hobley says action and transparency from Uber would be key from here.
We often see in the media Uber say we do not tolerate discrimination and we take this seriously. Well, now this is a really good time and a really good way to show that.
Disability advocate Paula Hobley ending that report by Naz Campanella. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Around 6,000 people had gathered to condemn the visit to Sydney by the Israeli president. There were violent clashes with police after they were ordered to disperse. Today, law professor Luke McNamara from the University of New South Wales on the new protest laws brought in after the Bondi attack and why the Labor government has gone too far. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.